You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and today I'm extremely pleased to have with me in what we'll laughingly refer to as the studio. When the boys were on their way around to me earlier on today, Stefan texted me and said, is there anywhere to park outside the studio? And I was like, guys, it's not the studio, it's my flat. Very pleased to have around to, we'll call it the studio from now on, very pleased to have the Midnight Beast. These are, I mean, I don't know how many of you will be familiar with the Midnight Beast. Their catchment, their demographic, if you like, is probably slightly younger than the average listening age of this podcast. They are massive, massive YouTube sensations. I hope you've done your homework by at the very least listening to TikTok. We're going to talk about that one in detail on the show, which was their parody of Kesha's TikTok in 2009, which by now has got something like 15.5 million hits. That will give you some idea of how they started. They've had a couple of series of their own show, The Midnight Beast, on E4. And as we'll hear, they're about to go to Comedy Central US as well. So, you know, I think we'll describe on the show the sort of thing that they are. I really am so pleased to welcome the show. And you can hear, I mean, I know every so often I have a guest on and you can basically hear me falling over myself. I was really excited. Obviously, there's a tiny part of me that is a teenage girl that thinks they're totally awesome. I know that teenage girls don't say totally awesome anymore. They probably say something in text speak that I couldn't translate. But nonetheless, enough faff. This is Ashley, Steph and Drew, otherwise known as the Midnight Beast.
Tell me what you're up to at the moment. Where do we find you in your careers at the moment? What are you up to?
Wow, we're 6 years. Six years, and it's kind of been a crazy 6 years, and it's just finding stuff to do now, I think. What are we doing? Comedy Central, yeah.
Yeah, we've done... So we've now done 2 studio albums and two seasons on E4, and we've departed E4. We're working on a new comedy venture with Comedy Central the States, yeah. Which is really exciting. At the moment, we're writing the pilot, so it could go either way, but we don't mind talking about that.
No,
but that has been super exciting because it's actually the first time we've experimented with comedy without music, actually. And we're collaborating with a guy called Aaron Blitzstein, and he did Family Guy and David Letterman, and he's amazing. So we've been Skype writing with him.
Yeah, so 5 hour Skypes of so it's different time zones, so you can see like we're doing it from 8 o'clock till midnight and he's early in the morning, so our ideas do dwindle towards the end. And but yeah, it's been a great process.
Crazy. For those of my listeners that don't know who you are, now I really hesitate to ask you about the TikTok parody, because that's, I mean, I've seen there's countless interviews of yours on YouTube already going, okay, what we did was, so that we know who you are. I'll tell you, in fact, I will introduce my listeners to you by the way I discovered you, which was maybe at Latitude a few years ago in the... In the cabaret tent, I think, that one they split into half and then the rejig other side. Me and a comic friend of mine, a guy called Mark, were outside and we were kind of walking past. I think he'd been on in that tent earlier on that day. Yeah. And we just heard screaming. And we were like, We thought you were for a moment. We were like, because someone invaded this incredibly nice middle class festival. We're going to look around and see some awful warlord. And we, just this tiny little tent was absolutely packed with screaming, predominantly girls, guys as well. Yeah. But, you know, in that kind of. Yeah. And we were like, this is like Beatlemania. Someone has Jesus returned. And we were looking outside trying to see what was going on. And we couldn't really. I remember Drew, I think, taking his hat off and throwing it into the crowd. But there was some sort
rock
of moment.
Rock there, right?
Yeah, there was a bit. You know, but we didn't really. I didn't know any of the songs. I could hear it was kind of a musical act, except people were going mental like they were at Wembley.
Yeah.
And then I think it was the following year I saw you at Bestival, and I'd seen that, I was like, I've got to check these guys out. And I remember looking at my watch in the afternoon and going, oh, Midnight Beast are on. And I took a bunch of friends of mine who were in their late 30s, early 40s, and I said, guys, we're going to go and see the Midnight Beast. And I was like, oh, what's that? You know, some of them were like, I only really like dubstep, or you know, I only really like, you know, whatever. And I said, and I remember trying to sell them what you were. I was like, no, they're like a boy band. They were like, get the fuck. I was sort of trying to say, they're like a boy band, but they're a spoof of a boy band, but they get to get all the benefits of being a boy band while taking the piss out of being a boy band. And they were like, okay, we'll give it a try. We got there halfway through your set, again, massive gig. And like 2 minutes in, I turned around and they were all behind me like they were 12 again, just smiling, just going mental. I was like, I know, right? I know.
Oh,
it was so
cool.
It was so awesome, man. It was the perfect introduction to your stuff. So is that fair? You're I mean, we'll talk about the transition away from music later on, but is that fair that what you've been doing for the last 6 years is you're basically a boy band?
Yeah, essentially.
You're a spoof boy band and a real boy band.
No, 100%. We've always played with the idea, and it's something we very openly admitted in our song "Just Another Boy Band," like which was about the seventh song we put up on our YouTube. Mm-hmm. And I mean, we started by accident of just making videos. Me and Drew's band would tour, and we'd like kind of do little vlogs on the side, and like parodies of adverts and stuff like that, and just getting used to filming with a camera, basically.
That's pre-TikTok.
That was pre-TikTok. Okay. And Ash would hang out with us a lot. We always hung out as the three and always had a want to do stuff together. But then we just put this TikTok video up, and it kind of and put it under the name The Midnight Beast, and it exploded, which was mad. And after that, we played on the idea of these dance routines, songs, this Just Another Boy Band track, and then we wrote a book because every boy band was doing that at the time, and we just thought we've got to spoof that too. And it's, that's kind of become, and weirdly, like you say, we attracted the fan base of boy bands, but I guess also the alternative fan base of kind of rock groups as well that wanted to take the piss out of boy bands, but then some boy band fans are like, and we got confused too.
And this is when YouTube had just started. Like, obviously now YouTube has become such a big platform for a lot of like vloggers and all different things, but you know, I'd like to say we're one of the originals, really, kind of like putting up content.
It's interesting to hear that you've been making stuff before TikTok, because I'm in the little research that I've done, I was like, okay, TikTok was the first thing, and you go back and look at it, and it's now on something like 15.5 million views. And I was looking at it going, this cannot possibly have been the first thing you've done, because from the mind of a comic, what I notice is the punchline density. There is a visual joke or an audio joke every 2 seconds, and often simultaneously. So had you been making that kind of stuff? Had you been making stuff that was like joke prior to TikTok?
To be honest, like, not really. No. I mean, I think the thing that we had to try and work out and didn't think about and thinking about now is really we wanted to make each other laugh and maybe a few of our mates and stuff. Yeah. And when it got down to it and suddenly people were taking interest that maybe weren't our age group, were younger, different sex, some older, we were kind of thinking for a second, we were like, well, how do we act as comedians? And then we just thought, we've got to just keep making stuff that makes the three of us laugh, because that's clearly what translates the best. And TikTok certainly was the first where we'd ever tried to. I mean, we had a track that came out a few videos later called Ninjas, and that we'd actually written, me and Drew had written before, and we were saying a lot of the time, like, if we put this up, no one's gonna care. Yeah. Like, it's kind of a spoof.
We're gonna get ripped.
Yeah, it's kind of
this?
Yeah, it's like a spoof of a spoof. It's like a spoof of Lonely Island spoofing a hip hop track kind of thing. And we loved them, and we didn't see what was different about us, so we did TikTok as a kind of experiment, like, let's just put out someone else's thing and see. And the fact that it kind of took off was mental. I mean, I edited it and produced it under my bunk bed. I was living at my mum and dad's house, and we just did it on iMovie, like the first edition kind of thing. And I'd always loved editing. We'd always loved producing. That was certainly something we'd done before, but never joke writing between the two of us.
It made me think, when I initially saw that, I was like, these guys are so young, and there's parts of the editing which I know nothing about editing, but it seemed to me sufficiently professional, just like the bit at the end where you kind of slot together all the just the sort of the shape of it seemed really professional.
Wicked.
I ended up thinking, have they been created? Yeah. Is there some sort of Svengali figure in the background? Yeah. Is there like a spoof of Louis Walsh who has created you guys?
Puppeteer.
I wish. That'd be a good mockumentary, actually.
Yeah, right. So you were thinking in terms of jokes, when you were putting it together, and we'll stay with TikTok for a minute.
Yeah.
Did you kind of storyboard it beforehand, or did you just have a camera for a day and just shoot loads of stuff? Did you know what shots you were taking?
So it definitely wasn't planned. Like, I remember us being there, and the visuals, we were just like looking around Stefan's house and seeing what we could actually attach to different lyrics and stuff. And then obviously with your editing brain, you thought different things would work, but it was mainly just us improvising, just having a laugh, really. Finding immature things funny. Like, I was just like, let's zoom into this Barbie's tits for one scene, for one shot and stuff. And like, it's basically just us fucking around, really. There wasn't anything planned or any storyboards.
And I think it's always a bit of the best of both. Like, we always normally print out lyrics and we'll make a couple scribbles on them, and then know that if we don't come up with stuff kind of there and then it's not going to have that improv feel as well, I think.
Yeah,
and like Ash is saying, like, just calling out, oh, this bit will work, but then maybe this bit, we knew we'd shoot that at the kitchen table. But that was all in a day. Like, it wasn't like the night before we'd been like, all right, day before the shoot, let's get all the props ready. And
We went out the night before, and that's how it all came together. Like, I wasn't even supposed to be in this video, really. No. It just so happened I was in this video, and then 6 years later, I'm still doing it.
Exactly.
Still attached.
One of the things that really strikes me about that video, and then what I guess went on to become your part of the flavour of the Midnight Beast online, is that combination of sort of, I want to say high production values, but they're quite low production values, but it's kind of a high production ethic. Yeah. I don't know quite what that word is.
Definitely. I mean, we've always said lo-fi in the sense of, I mean, I had just, maybe the year before, I'd got the video of Spike Jonze's kind of anthology of music videos and stuff, and all the fisheye stuff and everything with the Beastie Boys and who's the other? Spike Jonze and... was the director?
Michelle Gondry?
Yeah, Michelle Gondry. And all that kind of ethos of lo-fi video directing. And I think it was very popular at the time in commercials as well, where that lo-fi-ness, people would want to make something that looked like it was made on a budget. Okay. And I think from the early days after TikTok kicking off, like, we would like, well, the only way we can make something that is good is by embracing the fact that we don't have any money and we've literally got £5, and so we'll just make it look lo-fi, but we're not making it look, it just is lo-fi in a way. And I think
that's the charm of it, really, wasn't it?
And when we had a bit more money to spend, like coming into the TV show and stuff, we always just said, look, don't spend that money on that, spend it on this, on almost the planning stage of it, because the lo-fi-ness you can't fake, I think.
Yes, and you have to turn up and get, you know, you maybe you can't go out and buy a mermaid Barbie to do a crash zoom on their boobs. You've got to find one in your house for it to seem authentic.
That was something we understood about the way that the three of us almost are parts in the Midnight Beast, because I overly plan everything. I always have, and these guys have been way better at kind of going, look, just like take a step back from it and remember, most of the things we did in the early days was just improvised and stuff. Yes. And whereas I'll always be like, well, if we don't get that bit for that, then it's like, fucked kind of thing. And that's what's worked with us. We've always pulled each other in the direction that it kind of was in the early days, I think.
Okay. Which has been good. And as far as your kind of dynamic as a group of a co-performers, how much of what's in like the public, the performative persona of Midnight Beast reflects your actual relationship?
I mean, I think it's very similar.
Yeah.
As we found out today,
it's very similar.
What does this mean?
So, it's kind of embarrassing. So, basically, we were having a conversation about, what was it? It was
slang, basically. Yeah. It was... It was because Ashley plays a persona of being a bit stupider than he is in stupider. That's a word.
Yeah.
than he is in real life. We've got a bit at the end of our track Medium Pimpin' where we say cheese. Ash goes, "What's cheese?" And Drew goes, "It means money." And he goes, "Oh," and that ends it. And it's flipping the hip hop sensibilities down to just that. And Ashley literally asked us what cheese meant the other day, and it was just one of those things. That you said that's a lie.
That's
your
lie. That's why we did that joke years ago. Exactly. Was because of that.
He's been learning since.
He's not learning.
Do I take it then that your dad did actually run away with a cleaner, as you refer to on about 30 of your songs?
He doesn't like to talk about it.
Yes. Yeah, I'm just going to drink some.
He's been drinking water on that question since day one.
Yeah, just always managed to avoid the question, really.
Okay, is it just kind of coincidence then that you seem to fairly, as a group of performers, you fairly accurately represent the three types of boy band?
I think that's kind of been the appeal as well with our fan base. It's kind of like they have seen something in each of us that have kind of, they've seen it on stage and they've seen it in videos, and even when we've done interviews or met them, it's kind of portrayed in real life. I mean, I certainly like to be quite a relaxed kind of, oh, it'll be all right on the night kind of thing. And as they said, it's a lot more planning, and then, you know, it's just, yeah, I think that kind of comes across both in the videos and in real life.
And the TV show we did on E4, we heightened the personalities, but they're all, I think the best comedy, always the comedy that we grew up loving, the stuff like The Office was the first thing that we all related to each other in the UK Office. And I think with stuff like that, it's just relatable situations, and that's always what's been the funniest to us. So if there's not a situation that Ash has said something like that, then we don't want it in the script. And it's the same with Drew, and it's the same with me.
And I think as well, it's like we were saying, how we first started was to make each other laugh and make our friends laugh. And I think that's why the sort of realness of each of our personalities come out, is because if I do something that I don't think will make these two laugh, then there's no point in it going in a song or in a video. And it's kind of the same for all of us, really.
It is, exactly. That's been the most important thing. If we don't laugh in the room, it's not going in. Even if someone laughed when we told it to them that morning, it's not the same kind of thing. It's been the best judgment call.
It's really the only reason we've kind of carried on for so long, is because we've all enjoyed it and we've all still made each other laugh with it. Whereas they said, if it hasn't, it's like, well, that's not going anywhere. We'll leave that one at the door.
And is that, this might be jumping ahead slightly, but is that a kind of a creative control that you've managed to keep hold of those reins when you were doing the E4 series? Were you, that's sort of something you don't hear very often in TV, when people make that jump to doing TV,
in some
they kind of go, they overruled us on this.
But it was a bit half really with the E4, because, you know, with the writing of the script, I mean, we had ideas, but we had a team that would write the script kind of without us, really.
Yeah, it started with us, but we all threw our hands up and said, look, we've never written a script, and we don't want to come out with a show. We want to do a show. We're not going to park it for 2 years while we learn how to write a script, because this opportunity may not, may not ever come back. But at the same time, we didn't want to say to everyone, we've done that, we can write a script, because we couldn't at the time. So we decided to, we'd come up with the ideas with the writers in the room, and we'd approve the best ones. Then they'd go off and they'd write it.
Control over the sorts of things that were in it and the kind of flavour of the show.
But it started with our songs. I think the first series is more like basing the storylines around different songs of what people knew and all that that kind of thing. But
and we learned a lot from that.
You couldn't really base a storyline around a song. Well, you could, but then things wouldn't work, and it just didn't make sense in some parts, and things seemed a bit too surreal because of the song. And
when you were trying to sort of retroactively go, the song exists, let's try and put all the pieces in place in the plot, so the song makes sense.
But that was harder, because in the second series, we based it around the songs driving the storyline. So it'd make more sense, it would flow better, and I think that definitely worked better with the second series, I think.
And that's something we ended up doing. We made a three-part mini opera series with Comedy Central. It was our first time ever working with them, and it was the US office, but we made it online, and it launched on their YouTube channel, and that was the first time we collaborated with a friend, Tom George, and he sat in and he wrote the songs with us, and we wrote the script with him.
Yeah. Yeah.
And because they overlapped, and you learned something new about Ash's character in the first song, that he got a tattoo the night before, but when the song started, you didn't know that, and when the song finished, you did.
Yeah.
Okay.
And that meant that we could sell more in 3 minutes than we ever could in 23 minutes with three songs. because what would happen is the storyline would be going along, we'd get to a club, and we'd want to survey it for a party scene or something. I can't remember the exact storyline in the first episode, but then through the course of the song, no storyline activity happens, and because none of that happened, you literally, by the end of the song, you've got to kind of go, oh, what was happening with the storyline? And so you found you're actually almost wasting minutes.
It stilted, didn't it? It just, like, it froze, and it wasn't, it didn't
drive. That's such a production thing to say. It's like, you're wasting minutes.
Yeah. It really is.
You have to think that.
Yeah. No, definitely. And that was something, we always wanted everything to be hard-hitting and funny every second kind of thing. And I think that was a big thing we learned about the TV process and control. Yeah. And luckily, I managed... the first series, because I edited all the music videos with a little help from moving from iMovie over to Final Cut Pro from a friend. He kind of coached me over and helped me edit them. And when we got to the first series, it was something I was told I couldn't do, like was be involved in the editing. But then the second series, I managed to get back involved in it and edit the music videos. And that was brilliant because it meant that... Because I think really the three points of comedy that has always happened with us and with music that you're really lucky to have is it's the writing of it and then... writing and recording of it. Mm-hmm. So there's almost two in there. Then when you film the video, you get to add a whole bunch of new stuff. And then the editing of it, you get to... create more jokes within the edit, and that's always something we've tried to do, is not just have jokes in the song, in the video, but also in the edit as well. And I think that's another level of kind of funny you can have, and that was something that dramatically changed for the second series. Yeah. I think,
but we've had a learning curve over the past, I think, 2 years of filming the two series leading up to the pilot that we're creating for Comedy Central, and we've learned so much more that we can kind of like put all our ideas into this idea that we have.
It was interesting when we did do the series one filming, and like it was, you know, if, as we were saying, some scenes felt sort of crowbarred in because they're existing songs. But at the time, obviously, we were just sort of going with it. It was a whole new experience. Yeah. So it was really interesting the second time around to actually view that and go back and watch the first series and actually realise it was moving a million miles an hour and why and all of that stuff. It was a really cool like learning process.
Yeah.
It made the second one seem a lot more seamless. Like, I'm not saying we were sort of like veterans at doing it.
Sure.
It was only a second time
I think
round,
it's definitely from the episodes I've seen, I feel like the second series is a lot stronger. And I think for that reason as well, it feels like from the very beginning of the second series, that lot, you know, the outside dance sequence and everyone kind of working together.
Yeah.
It feels like the story is serving the songs.
Wicked.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Great.
It's definitely the approach.
So thank you to the boys for coming round. As you can hear, I think we all had a load of fun doing this, and we even managed to get Drew to occasionally speak, so that's good. More from them in just a moment. There's still time to get your tickets for Mark Watson. That's the next live British. Yeah, in fact, the next live podcast I'm doing is in a few days with Mitch Benn in Estonia. But assuming you're not listening in Tallinn, the next live one you can see is at the Secret Welsh Festival next week. That is going to be Mark Watson in the Vortex venue at 5:30 on the Sunday. You can Google up the details by searching for the Secret Welsh Festival's Secret Welsh name. Come along and see that. And of course, there's still tickets available for Nina Conti live at Soho Theatre, the second one in the run of the first Tuesday of the month live ComCom shows. Remember, you can get your tickets for May the 5th with Nina Conti and get a 25% discount using the discount code FAFF, F-A-F-F, at SohoTheatre.com. Please don't miss that. I mentioned last time her documentary. It is, of course, I remembered shortly after recording these, Her Master's Voice. I don't know how easy it is to find in the UK. I managed to borrow a copy of it. Possibly you can still get it on Amazon. But if you have a copy of that already, rewatch it and get ready to have that thoroughly explored live at Soho Theatre on May the 5th. A quick plug for someone else's thing. It just occurred to me, if you're a podcast person, why not give John Robbins and Ellis James's XFM show podcast a listen? As far as I'm concerned, they're the new Adam and Joe. Both of them always very welcome on this show. I've had a chat to Ellis recently. We'll try and get a date in. to have Ellis on the show. Brilliant stand-up in his own right, as is the wonderful John Robbins. Brilliant stand-ups both, but when they are together, the chemistry of two reedy, pedantic men complaining about things and celebrating the music of Queen and indeed ancient British coin collections, all kinds of stuff. But what they do that reminds me specifically of Adam and Joe is that they're really, really good at giving the sort of giving the show to the audience, if you know what I mean. They're really good at, as Adam and Joe always were brilliant at doing, following their own stupidly, instantly improvised sentences to the end of the breath. Like, you know that they don't know what they're going to say next. It's very funny. But also they're really good at opening up and responding to audience challenges and suggestions and questions and games and stuff like that. Really, really good fun. And I say that as someone who frequently doesn't advertise things my friends do because I want to keep you all for myself. But do download the John Robbins and Ellis James XFM Show podcast. And add that to your podcast list. Thank you, of course, for your donations. You too can donate to support the show by paying me 20 quid as a one-off payment, or a tenner, or a fiver, or 100 quid, a pound a show, or whatever else you think is reasonable. But please do not tick the button that says regular payment, because it still doesn't work. We are on it, I promise. Simply click on the donate button on the PayPal link at comedianscomedian.com. If you have a Patreon account, you can support us at patreon.com/comcompod, or simply come up to me at a gig sometime and press some dirty cash into my hand, say something cool, and walk away without a second word. So that's that. Thanks for all your donations thus far. Very much appreciated as ever. And do keep them coming in. And finally, before we get back to the Midnight Beast, I've got a new initiative. I was thinking recently about people I would like to, people who in my wildest dreams I would love to invite onto this show. Recently, I've been making some advances towards various slightly curveball-shaped guests, people you wouldn't necessarily expect. I mentioned I'd emailed Henry Rollins recently, and in fact, I remember hearing recently that Rowdy Roddy Piper listens. My door is always open to Rollins or Rowdy Roddy Piper. But I was thinking, ultimately, who do I want? Who is the biggest comedian in the world? I don't think it's Russell Peters. I don't think it's Gervais or Tosh or Chris Rock even, or Louis. I think the biggest comedian in the world is Jackie Chan. He is, if you've ever seen any of his films, you'll know how naturally funny Jackie Chan is. He's basically a clown. The kung fu and the stunts are all sort of secondary to that. So hashtag get me Jackie Chan. I'm starting an initiative now, which I'm going to continue in future episodes, possibly forever, until somebody gets me Jackie Chan. One of you must know someone who knows someone who knows someone who knows Jackie Chan. So let's start a little spider web of people asking each other if they can possibly get... Every time you hear the word Jackie Chan in conversation, ask everyone in that conversation, do you know Jackie? Can you get hold of Jackie? Can you get him on the Comedians Comedian podcast? My door is open, info@comedianscomedian.com, or tweet me at ComComPod with the hashtag get me Jackie Chan. Let's bombard the incredible, wonderful man who I just grew up with his movies and I think he's hilarious. I want him on the show. So let's bombard his Twitter account with requests for him to get in touch with me. And let's see if I would never normally ask you to bombard someone, but I think he's like the fourth most recognizable person on the planet. So he can probably take it. Get me Jackie Chan. Now let's get back to the Midnight Beast.
So this the mini opera. Now I haven't seen that. Has that been released or is
that has? Yes, and we were so happy with how that ended up because it was the first time since the early music videos that we'd ever been involved in every single aspect of it. And Comedy Central gave us a budget, and because it was a web series, it wasn't much, but we employed every mate of ours to do every role that we knew that they could do best. And, and it was the first time really, because the TV series, we didn't have sign off because we weren't producers on it, whereas we were on this. And it was the first time we could sign off, spend a bit more money on this, which wouldn't be usual in the creation of a TV show or whatever, and spend a little less on this, because we don't need that with a Midnight Beast.
What are the kind of thises that you're talking about? Spend less money on a location or...
Exactly.
Less money on lunch.
Yeah.
We can spoil our food.
A macro sandwich.
But
I mean, that's probably true, you laugh, if you're employing a producer, they want to eat properly. Yeah, exactly. If it's you can make do with the plate.
Exactly. That's it.
Even down to getting our mates involved, just come and be an extra and stand around and, you know,
please,
we need you.
Yeah. I know. I mean, not a single aspect of the Midnight Beast hasn't been pleading people to do a freebie. But, no, exactly, and that worked, and it, I think it got...
450,000 in the first week.
Yeah, it was really... Which was a web series.
I'm just going to pause for a moment and just say I really enjoyed that moment of the apparently scatty Ash going 450,000.
I'm very good with numbers and that kind of thing. Common sense, fuck that. Yeah. But anything else, I'm quite good at memorising that kind of thing. But within the first week, it actually did really well.
Yeah.
And it carried on and... Yeah, they were very impressed, weren't they?
Yeah.
It was really good.
That's Comedy Central in the US?
US,
it is.
Okay, so can we see it? Is there anywhere I can find it online?
So it's on CC Studios, and and it's called After the After After Party, and luckily there hasn't been anything called that, so if you Google that, it's online, it's basically the three of us wake up on the aftermath of a house party and we're re-piecing together what happened last night. And to be honest, it's the most surreal we've ever gone with our comedy. Mm-hmm. And it was so fun because there were no limits. And and where I said a lot of relatable stuff always made us laugh, I think the fun with that was it was relatably surreal, which I think is always something quite interesting, that things like the Mighty Boosh, you know, where suddenly there's a really bizarre scenario that just comes crashing down with something very normalised kind of thing.
Okay.
And I think that was great fun playing with that.
So just going back to this, I'm interested in this kind of the apportionment of the budget. If you're saving money on sandwiches and extras and all the rest of it, what are you spending that money on? Is it prep time? Is it time with you know, directors? Or how does that work?
A lot of the time it's things like... things like prop making, like, was very important with that, as you'll see in the third episode, things like
because we do spend a lot of money on props. I mean, in all our videos, we spend nothing on everything else, but the props we spend a little bit of money on. And
what's the thinking behind that? Because they've got to look. I mean, I would guess they've got to look kind of crap in the right way.
Is that what I'm thinking?
When you're doing I'm the Main One.
Yeah.
In fact, you've got those cardboard suits that look homemade, but they look homemade to a good standard.
Yeah. That's it. And to be honest, the one thing that has made writing every treatment in inverted commas, because sometimes it's not so much a treatment, but for every music video is the literal lyrics. And that's been a thing that we've always tried to do, is if somebody's talking about cleaning a sink, there's got to be a sink and a pair of gloves kind of thing.
Okay.
And if you've got that for every single lyric, it starts adding up a lot. So and that was literally something that we would sit down with a TV show and they'd kind of go, well, you know, we've spent money on these lights and we've got all this crew and stuff, we've got no money for props. And we'd be like, well, every lyric needs a gag, and the main one, and it's funny that you said that one automatically, was the first video we ever did in the whole creation of the series. So it must have been maybe the 13th video we did with E4, where they went, you guys can spend money on props in this one. And that was the first one where every lyric has a prop-based gag. And that was kind of the theme of TikTok as well, where kind of from... Because otherwise I feel like the writing of the song itself is a waste, because if you're not pointing out the lyrics, almost a gag for us has been overly pointing out the lyrics, going, this is what we say, and we're doing it too, kind of thing. And I think that was what was so fun with the main one, and having fun with all the earlier videos, is spending money on props, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting that you... I wouldn't have expected you to say we literally do a visual prop for every gag, because I suppose something that your work reminds me of is, I don't know if you've ever seen Zero Punctuation.
No.
Video game reviews by a guy called Ben Yahtzee Croshaw.
Amazing.
And they're high speed, angry, like 3-minute video game reviews about, you know, Fallout 3 or Half-Life or whatever.
Right.
Where he's, and it's a little cartoon thing, and he's I really recommend anyone listen to this watch, they're very, very funny. Yeah. But the way he works is he's doing high-speed criticism of now you end up with this, and then you go to there, and you get really cheesed off because you can't find the key at the end of the thing. Yeah. And then at the same time, he's got these little kind of animated figures, nicely kind of like even below South Park standard. Simple. But he kind of like, he does a gag, like an audio gag, and then a different visual gag.
Oh, wow.
So I've come away from TikTok and a lot of your work feeling like that's what you do. But it's interesting to hear you say that there's, a lot of the time, the visual is underlining the joke.
But then actually, a lot of the time, that's where these guys really come in. Because I'll kind of go, we need Febreze for this kind of gag kind of thing. And then, when it comes to the filming, these guys will change what we've planned and just do something else on top of it. And I think that, and that's where that kind of level of it comes on, where there's like the pre-planning, but then there's that improv stage of filming.
Where they basically try and knacker your best laid plans.
Exactly,
essentially. and that's
what's always worked, because I think at the end of the day, if you stand there and just present a prop, there's only so much funny you're going to have. Whereas if the facial expression is doing something else and there's an extra gag that we've thought of on the day, then it also
it's
works.
It's just like a full-on assault, isn't it? Yeah. It's impossible. Like you say, every second, we can't waste minutes.
No,
It's messed up a few guidelines and then kind of weaving them out of them.
Definitely.
I like, know the boundaries of, like, this is kind of roughly what we've got, but let's just fucking go.
So after TikTok, what was the first, because that was a parody of an existing song, what was the first original song that you wrote from scratch?
That was Ninjas.
Which
which you had written beforehand.
Which we had written before. And because we came up with TikTok, and the idea was we were going to do TikTok and then Ninjas, but we thought this has worked so well. It's coming up to Christmas. We may as well do a Christmas song. So then we did All I Want for Christmas Is You, our parody Triple Xmas Buddies, and then and then we also did a parody of Down, which was high in the UK charts at the time, and then we came out with Ninjas. I think in that order.
It's kind of interesting that even after putting Ninjas out, and maybe even the next one that was an original, like, we were still kind of considered this parody thing, which is kind of interesting because obviously all of our originals are still a sort of pastiche of an artist or a genre. So it's kind of cool and odd at the same time that we've kind of been labelled as this parody act.
Do you find TikTok is kind of a millstone because you're known as those? I mean, that's your most successful video, isn't it?
Yeah.
And it's the first. And in the annoying way the internet works, when you put something out, it's had a six-year head start on anything you release now in terms of numbers.
That's it. And that's been the bizarre thing. And I think we've had numerous conversations of kind of going, you know, should we try and capitalize on another parody like that? And we've and we've done throwbacks to it on the 3-year anniversary. We did Die Young, we did Die Old, which was by Kesha, and that was a 3-year anniversary. And it's been lovely to go back to those roots, but at the same time, the stuff that we've achieved and been able to do because of that parody is kind of mad, I think. And we still play it now, and you know, we have to play it last in the same way that Aerosmith have to play Walk This Way last. Like, it's mental that we kind of come out and still do it. And people still know the words to that song over hers. And I think that's amazing. It's crazy.
You're right. I don't know any of the words to the original. I'm probably not a best example of a Keisha fan or Kesha. I don't even know.
Keisha.
The middle class person. I was thinking, for most comics, there's this kind of like a long running theme, I think, that comics want to be rock stars and rock stars secretly want to be comics.
Yeah.
And you pricks get to do the best of it. But you have this kind of, I was interested to ask about that, because obviously what a comic wants to do is, having written a brilliant bit, you want them to go, do your bit about staircases or whatever, so you can go, I'm just going to rest on my laurels and do my own stuff.
Yeah.
But presumably a band are thinking, Christ, I don't want to play Walk This Way again, because I've literally done it 3 million times.
Well, I mean, I think it's a love and hate thing, because I actually personally, whenever I go and see a band that I loved kind of back in the day, and maybe it's 10 years later or something, if they don't do the old stuff, I kind of think, like, what the fuck? Like, because, like, at the end of the day, I understand that there has to be progression and they have to do that. And I think the thing is, if we were to say, well, what we did on Shtickheads, our second album, kind of, you know, we can't play TikTok because it doesn't work with the ethos of Shtickheads. I think it would just sound like an absolute... I mean, it'd be funny to do it in a spoof way, but at the same time, like, we've never felt that high on a pedestal that we can't break out and do kind of TikTok again. I think the thing is it's what we owe to bringing the three of us together. Yeah. And I think at the end of the day... And the cool thing about doing it live, which is... playing a live show with music rather than with a comic, is it's a lot easier to put variants on it and kind of merge it in with the new sound if we do it on instruments or whatever. We can always have fun with, like, we do it, we quite recently we've been getting back in touch with a lot of the fans with kind of going out and doing DJ sets, and the fact that we can just break out and do that without having dances or instruments or whatever is brilliant.
So what would you do? What would I expect to see if I came along to a Midnight Beast DJ set? Is there, how much of a live show is that? I never know what that means if people like a DJ set. It basically says, I'm not doing the thing.
Pretty much.
Do we turn up and it's you with an MP3 player? What is it?
You get a little more people.
We took pride in actually being able to DJ rather than rocking up with our iPhone.
Yeah.
But you can actually... You can mix.
Yeah. We can do the old mixing.
Yeah.
Who's the best mixer out of you three?
Probably Steph. Steph. We've more recently, Ash and I kind of got into it. But we were adamant to sort of learn properly rather than sort of just have one of us be able to do it and then everyone's just kind of like,
write my check.
Exactly, that's it.
But amongst that as well, because we obviously play a lot of other people's songs, kind of throwback kind of stuff and guilty pleasures. And then we do throw in like two or three of our own songs as well and kind of run around up front like with Beastie Boys. So that's always fun.
Yeah,
and we also have like water pistols and kind of like load it up with alcohol.
Yeah, which get confiscated sometimes.
Yeah,
which gets confiscated, or they want, you're not going to squirt that in anyone's mouth. Yeah. What else are we going to do with it?
But and then again, it's, we like to kind of take pride in the fact of our DJ set being almost a spoof of the electronic dance music DJ scene as well.
Because
I think everything that's fun to do with what we've managed to do is spoofing stuff. And I think where the boy band stuff is, almost all the boy bands we were pastiching were like JLS and The Wanted. And it's now this One Direction phase of 5 seconds of summer with instruments. And that everything moves so quick. Yeah. You have to be so on it to kind of spoof a new thing, and I think that's...
None of it is ever meant to be serious. Like, it's always just been a bit of a tongue-in-cheek kind of vibe. Yeah, you know, as I said, from down to the DJ set to a normal live set, it's just like...
And are there any drawbacks to having to kind of follow the pattern of a boy band? Like, one of the ones that I thought most obviously must be like... You're getting older. Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
How old are you guys? Are you in your sort of mid-20s?
26.
What's your showbiz age?
Exactly. Showbiz age.
I'm 28.
Okay.
And we're 26.
Yes.
Yeah, me and Ash.
And we started it when we were 20.
Why do this to you?
20. Yeah, 20. 20.
21. So it's good age.
So are you,
it's an age.
Yeah. So what are the kind of... Are you kind of... I always wonder if you're kind of Googling the things that go wrong with boy bands so that you can be prepared. We've written a watertight contract, but we all own all the stuff, and we'll never fall out over the money. I wonder, are there actually serious kind of drawbacks to, like, have you got to, you know, if you're pastiching music, have you got to listen to a load of music that you're not interested in order to be able to pastiche it?
I mean, to an extent, I think Drew makes a lot of music with beats and I've always a song written for other artists as well, and so songwriting, it always comes from, I don't think we could stand up on stage and parody a song that we didn't like the original in a way. And to be honest, TikTok I thought was one of the best songs that had been out in ages, which is, to be honest, why we did it. And we don't do a lot of parodies because we don't love a lot of songs like we did TikTok. And I had a real, like, the creation of that tune was by an amazing songwriter called Dr. Luke and Benny Blanco as well. And the two of them together made this tune. And what it was doing was so different of everything at the time. And I think we did that because we've taken the mick out of the contrived kind of thing of the lyrics and her saying all of this and I go out till this time. And they were so funny to us. But at the same time, a love of the fact that, you know, when we play that live, the beat's amazing. You know, it sounds great. The melody's so good. And we're just doing the same melody that she does and stuff. Yeah. And I think that's the thing. Everything that we parody comes from a love of it because we want to be up on stage doing that in a way. And you know, even down to the dance routines, like, they're things that are so silly, but they're so good. Like,
this
they feel
it.
So,
this,
like...
This is what I remember watching you live and seeing, like, oh, my God, now they're doing a, you know, a proper choreographed dance routine with those guys that run on as backup dancers.
Yeah.
And then glitter cannons. And I'm like, this is the biggest case of have your cake and eat it. And we're just making fun of this stuff.
No, you aren't.
You're doing it.
No, exactly. That's it. And I think that's the thing. It's always come from the love of all that stuff, of doing it. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing it, I think. Because we'd be doing it and be cringing at that part of the song. And not at all. Yeah. If that answers the question.
I think so. Let's talk about writing then. Go back to the original, the writing process. Let's stick with Ninjas because obviously with TikTok, you know, you're writing to an existing melody, I suppose, and you're writing gags. Maybe they appear a bit more easily.
Yeah.
But with your own work, when you write a song, what does that look like? And I should say at this point, of my many of the tracks I enjoy on your last two albums, on your two albums, none have made me nearly crash the car quite so much as when you're freestyling. The secret track.
That's amazing.
Honestly, I'm just really crying with laughter. And we should just explain what those tracks are.
Wicked. I mean, that's been an ongoing thing since the first... it was the first album.
I feel like
we've done three.
No,
we've only done two. Yeah, no. It was the first album. We decided that we wanted to do a kind of freestyle rap parody and a secret track that basically at the end of the 10th song, there'd be a 2-minute gap and then the final track would come in. And so basically Drew and I made this beat and we each go in the booth for five. We all write two lines on our phone.
You mean go under your bunk bed?
Under my bunk bed. Yeah. We write two lines on our phone. Like best. I think we normally give ourselves like 2 minutes. It's almost a game. 2 minutes to come up with the best lines we can.
Yeah. Okay.
Then we'll use them probably for the first 4 seconds,
yeah.
And then just completely go off topic for about 5 minutes each, and then me and Drew will painstakingly sit there and edit all of the best bits, basically.
Yeah. There's a lot of
Those are the bits that make me laugh.
Yeah.
What I loved about that, it was really vulnerable.
Wicked.
Because you can clearly hear someone who can't freestyle.
Yeah.
Really having a solid go.
Exactly. That's it. And that's that. And it's so nice because all the other tracks are so, you know, written and produced. And they're the ones that are the improv kind of ones.
I feel like that's why we give ourselves a couple of minutes just to literally wean ourselves in to kind of just so we're not from the get go going, oh, fuck. All right.
Yeah.
Yes, right. I've got a couple of lines and now I'm on my own. Right. Okay. Yeah. What am I going to do?
Yeah. And then there's a lovely one where you just start naming things around the room. Packets of crisps. I'm literally naming stuff around the room. Like,
that's and then even with a laughter as well, we're like, you can sort of hear people cackling in the background.
Yeah, man. That's great. So if you're not freestylers, when you're writing, what does that look like in the room when you're like, okay, we're going to sit down and write a new track?
It's been different for everyone.
Numerous things.
We've had, a lot of the more singy musical, like we had, starting with Ninjas, I mean, that was actually before Ash got involved, that was pre-TikTok, that was Drew and I, we just loved, that was really the first time we'd ever looked at doing comedy music, as it were, I think.
And pastiche in the genre, really, we made a sort of weird hip-hoppy kind of beat.
Almost drop it like it's hot-y kind of thing. And so we were just playing with that, but I mean, and what we did there, which we still do now, is normally come up with a concept first, and that one was us being out in kind of clubs like Mahiki and stuff like that, and not having money to buy drinks, and seeing these tables flowing with alcohol, so just slipping our hand over and taking the drinks and walking away.
This is the nice middle class boys version of slinging rock on the corner, basically.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Exactly. And so that was the concept for Ninjas. So, I mean, we'll normally have the concept first, and then we'll go away and create a beat that we can shout over for 2 days, basically. And normally the enjoyment of just kind of throwing rhythms over a beat, you end up kind of funneling through kind of ideas of where each verse could go and what rhythms could do.
Yeah.
And then we'll start the process of being like, well, it really suits Ash's voice to do this bit, or it really suits Drew's to do that. And what we do, a lot of the early songs had the same kind of format where it was almost like, I'd have a verse, then we'd all do the chorus, then Drew would have a verse, we'd all do the chorus, Ash would do the bridge, we'd all do the chorus, then we're out kind of thing. And so a lot of the time that format helped us, but as we started getting more confident with writing together, we'd start throwing that away. And like Friends for Never, you weren't even there. Yeah. Ash came round.
And I decided, because I can't rap, but I'm trying, obviously. I'm from a musical like theatre background, so I wanted to kind of like do more of a musical one, like Friends for Never and Walk With Us and that kind of thing, so I could actually sing on the tracks more. And so,
guys, I am
as well. And I remember, I remember us writing Friends for Never and just creating it more to kind of like my voice and that. So that was cool.
Same with I'm So Manly. I came around and these guys have pretty much written the whole song.
Yeah.
I just kind of went for it.
That's it. Really
I'll get my clown makeup on. I'm ready to stand behind a window looking sad again.
Exactly. And I think that's been the fun thing about it. We've always, and with the TV show as well, with the first series, there were a few songs that we needed to write additionally. And then with the second one, it was pretty much from scratch. And we'd sit down with the scripts and go, all right, well, this script, it would be nice if it's about Ash going solo. So it'd be really nice to have a sad song, or it'd be really nice to have one where we've all got back together and stuff. And that would be the same process, to be honest. Just what's the funniest idea? And I remember more often than not, there'd be a script idea and we'd come back and we'd go, we can't come up with anything for that script idea. Scrap it. But we've got this song, let's write a script around this, kind of. And because I think the music always did the talking in the TV show. And I think that's something that we found with most of the career it has.
It's kind of where we sit on the sort of fine line between comedy and music as well. Is I think obviously because Steph and I have had the sort of background in music. Well, and obviously Ash was singing.
And this, this was the Brit School. Did you both go to that? Or
that was just me. Me and Ash met at Sylvia Young doing kind of performing arts, more musical theatre background of stuff. And Ash carried that on through into college. And then I went to the Brit School and did a lot more of the production side of stuff. And then from leaving that, Drew and I started bands. And you went to Drum Tech, literally just studied drums.
What was Drum Tech? Is that all right?
Just okay, literally drum school. Played drums. Okay.
Down the road.
Five, down the road from here.
Two streets down. And then Drew and I went on tour with our mates band Hadouken and we'd play a lot of just normal shows and got to see the academies and all that side of it and in our band the Click Click that was and got quite close to that world. And the Click Click was really tongue-in-cheek as well. Like we had a song called My Dunks, which was kind of a modern day blue suede shoes about night dunks and what they meant to a guy and his girlfriend kind of having a go at him because he was obsessed with them. And they all were quite tongue-in-cheek as well, but it was a little more musical. And I think that was the thing that got us excited about the Midnight Beast. We were like, we can make the track sound wicked and we can make the melody sound catchy and like kind of satisfying, but then you can sneak these really bad jokes in as well. And like some of them bad because they're so filthy and some of them bad because they're just terrible jokes, but they're so much funnier when you sing them. And I think that was the fun we had with it.
That's why
Family Guy and that like, get away with it in South Park, because it's very musical theatre based, really.
We've never sort of come out and been like we're sort of comedians or really ever kind of been comfortable on a sort of funny basis. I mean, as we said earlier, as long as we sort of make each other laugh and our friends laugh, that's always been our sort of like point of knowing we're on the right lines. But you know, coming from that music background and sometimes the start of writing our song will be from like a beat or something, so it's always kind of adding the comedy at a later point and kind of picking a line that's actually really funny, or you know, coming up with the concept, you know, like sort of lesbian friends, you know, if a girl isn't fancy, she's a lesbian, like it's so sort of stupid, but behind a sort of kind of electro kind of beat, it was kind of masked, it was a bit more subtle, but
your best songs I think really work as songs. They've got repeat value, which I think is something that a lot of comedy songs don't have.
It
reminds me of I mean, I'm a huge fan of Lonely Island, and I think clearly you are too. There's something about that, the way that their production is so absolutely first rate. It's as well produced as anything on the radio. And actually what you find is that I don't know, maybe you have a similar experience, but I hear one of their songs, the jokes make me laugh. I go back to it because the jokes make me laugh. The third, fourth time I've heard it, I realise I'm playing it because I actually like this. I have no interest in Rihanna. And then after Shy Ronnie Part 2, I'm like, I think you're a Rihanna fan.
It. And I think, and I mean, they are partnering up with like I'm on a Boat is produced by one of the biggest hip hop producers, and like all their stuff is done by those top tier songwriters. And I mean, they're coming in and delivering those incredible SNL jokes as well. So I mean, it's the dream team kind of thing, and we always came from the kind of even more lo-fi kind of Lonely Island thing because we were doing all that stuff ourselves just from a love of hip hop.
As soon as we can afford it,
we can do it. But yeah, exactly.
I think that's the thing as well, it's kind of, we've got these sort of fairly mundane, sort of quite amateur and silly lyrics, And then we kind of like pride ourselves in, you know, building quite a nice beat behind it. And I kind of feel like, although sometimes we use the odd silly sound effect, like in Friends Forever, there's that awful kind of penny whistle thing we use in the melody, which is perfect, and I couldn't imagine anything else. But I think sometimes, because we have quite a lo-fi sensibility in our editing and our videos, I think if the beat was equally as lo-fi, I don't think it would have its impact, and I don't think it would be as strong. Whereas because we, you know, we built these kind of like quite hard-hitting beats or you know, kind of guitar-y tracks, I think it's got that level of, you know, it's that fine blend, really. You can listen to it, as you were saying, like Lonely Island as a as a track where you're just nodding your head to, and then you're actually kind of laughing.
Yeah, but no, exactly. And that's been a common thing, because we're better song creators and producers than we are directors and filmmakers. But then the editing, I think, like, works hand in hand with the production, because they're quite similar things in the creation of a song and the creation
of
cut
to the beat and stuff.
Exactly, that's it. And that's why it always makes sense for me that the producer should be the editor in a way as well, because in a way, you've made that track with that drum beat, so why wouldn't you cut to it as well, I think. And that's something that's always worked for us. And there's a weird thing that I've noticed with a lot of stuff where if you watch a really lo-fi video where the track sounds lo-fi, like you're saying, it looks a lot more lo-fi than one with a track that's a bit more buffed
up.
The
same video.
Yeah. And,
I see what you mean.
And I feel like there's an element of kind of, you're kind of hearing what you're seeing and you're seeing what you're hearing. And there's a way that they partner up, which is really interesting. And I think we saw that with the production value of, there's a lot of YouTube videos that, I don't know how the kids are like getting the camera quality they get. We've never been good at lighting or cameras or that technicality of focusing and stuff. But with where a lot of them let themselves down with a lot of the parody acts on YouTube, especially, is the track, the video looks incredible, but the track itself doesn't sound as good.
Yeah.
And I think that you cannot get away with. But if the video looks pretty bad and the track's really good, you've got a better bass.
You can shoot the whole thing in a car park on a shopping trolley if it sounds like it's been incredible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a weird partnership. And
there's the odd exception with, you know, I know Sketch Group. I think there's even a Lonely Island song where it's the two guys, one of those, we're just two guys, we're having a good time. And like, the beat's quite mundane, then there's not much to it. And that kind of works, because I guess it's the sort of point of the song. But yeah, like, I think,
But the microphone quality is great, and it's just those little things that people don't care about.
Sure.
But it just,
maybe
like,
we're just massive music geeks.
I think
so. Well,
they're
using a better mic.
Well, this
is interesting, because I think there's clearly something that sets you apart from a lot of the other people out there who are doing something similar. And I have to say that not all of them are hugely on my radar. I mean, I know that, like you say, a lot of YouTube parody acts. I'm like, oh yeah, I guess that's a genre, isn't it? That's like a whole thing.
Yeah.
But so do you think what sets you apart is the fact that you have this kind of musical background? It certainly sounds like it, that you you're making decisions based on the decisions a DJ, an editor and a producer would make, whereas 99% of other parody acts are trying to get a cop joke in, trying to rhyme a certain word or something.
Well, yeah, I think there's a certain, we've always tried to have quality control, and I think in a big way that's let us down with building subscriber counts and the kind of things that YouTube is really important with, and is often a reason why we don't always, we're not always as involved with the YouTube community as maybe we should be, I think. Because YouTube is about quantity. And I think we've always tried to make the best. And we've scrapped a lot of songs. We've scrapped a lot of videos and stuff. Because we always feel like if you don't end up with the best possible way of selling a joke, then there's just no point putting it up. And there is often a, if you don't have a video up every week, you're going to lose your subscribers. And we understand that world, but it's hard to fit.
It's definitely the quality, because a lot of the parody acts out there feel like their lyrics are just kind of not really thought about. And they just kind of like do what is in the actual video, the actual music video, and just take the piss out of the music video. Whereas I think we try and find a different angle on something, and if it's not a different angle and it's not, you know, a lot different, then it's like, what's the
point? I think as well, I mean, obviously say if you guys disagree, but I think for me as well, I think it will draw the fun out of it as well. I think because it is like a constant, like every week there's got to be a new video, and sometimes, like, I know my brain's not that quick at, you know, thinking of ideas, and sometimes that can be a drawback. But I think, yeah, if you're pressured to doing that every other week, it's kind of like, I would rather be really, really happy with a video or a video or something, a song or something, and let that kind of breathe and let that kind of be a discussion, let people enjoy it rather than like, oh, by the way, here's the next one. Like, I've only just seen that one.
Like a factory. I think the lyrics get lazy. That's what it is. Yeah. Like, they're just like, we churn this out every week and we know we're going to get this amount of hits.
Yeah.
So it doesn't matter what we put out. It's not me just being us, but I'm just saying, like, I've seen some stuff and it's just like, what's the point, really? You know you're going to get a million views per week.
Mm.
But your quality of it is just it's poor. It's poor.
Yeah, I mean, and this is fascinating. This is a conversation I haven't had before. I would say out of all the people I've interviewed, you've probably got one of the biggest internet presences, apart from like someone maybe like Bo Burnham or something.
Yeah, right, yeah.
But it's amazing to hear you go, oh, the thing is, we're not very good at YouTube.
But that is the same with Bo Burnham. And that's interesting. Like, even with Bo Burnham's got an insane following.
Yeah, yeah.
And especially, he's really translated to the comedy world as well. Mm. But Bo Burnham is one of the least prolific YouTubers out there. I mean, but all his stuff on YouTube is incredible. And it is not a thing on all YouTubers of genres, because there's this whole gaming model like PewDiePie and KSI. And they are great, and they found a way. Gaming videos are easy to create, and it's the biggest thing
on YouTube.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, Minecraft has half the views of YouTube, just Minecraft videos.
Oh,
yeah,
my insane. God.
Yeah,
stats.
It's crazy.
Yeah,
stats. Yeah.
Boom!
Such a
you can genuinely put that out there with really good quality every week.
Yeah.
But writing a song, directing a music video, then editing it to a good standard, you couldn't do it, I think.
Okay.
And I think we realised that quite early on. Are we going to start a gaming channel just to stay in touch with our fans?
Mm.
No, like, because, like, I just don't think... We tried it, we've tried it a lot, but the thing is...
Did you try a gaming channel?
We did, yeah. We tried the idea, we thought about it,
but we never put it up there.
We filmed something. but just... Because you may as well put the time into, like, writing and stuff.
Yeah.
And we've always been keen to translate out of YouTube as well as be involved in YouTube. And we haven't been afraid to say that. And I think some people feel like it's one or the other, or you're dead to us kind of thing.
YouTube's either a sort of full-time job or it's like just a sort of fun creative thing, and we've been really fortunate that our early videos gave us a platform and the sort of fan base. And I think we have taken it a bit more like a band would a record with a record label, like putting it out when they've written it and when they've done it, whereas as we're sort of getting at, as a lot of YouTubers will just kind of, I filmed something cool, I'm gonna whack it up, and I think for us it would just saturate and take the fun out of it, really.
It's interesting as well, because in terms of like a long-term strategy, the first thing that made me think is, that's really smart, because you're kind of going, look, we don't want to be tied to YouTube forever.
Mm.
But at the same time, maybe 20 years from now, YouTube is going to be all there is.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You've got a sense of like,
exactly,
trying to predict the future. Of going, like, for me, it would not, I'm certainly of an era where, no, the important thing is to drive up and down motorways gigging every night of the week. It's hilarious to you. And why wouldn't it be? You can be in the studio uploading stuff and making money and, you know, making... You know, providing a live platform for yourself, you guys don't need to do the circuit.
No.
So I mean, you don't need to go and headline a commercial comedy club in front of, you know, stag dudes, because you retain the you know, the means of production, if you like. So what do you anticipate happening in the future of TV production?
I mean, I think even seeing like 4OD changing to All Four, and now they're advancing shows on that before they're on Channel 4, and you can download them to your devices now, and the way that has changed with us being involved in Channel 4, and we were one of the first acts that most of our viewing on Channel 4 was on 4OD, and they were saying that was the first time they'd seen that, and seeing them progress to that, and them kind of being like, you know, well, we're going to give the internet users the exclusives rather than the TV users, is already a telltale sign that it's going into that kind of like, we don't want TV when you schedule it, we want TV when we want it scheduled, thing. And I want to watch it at a time I can watch it. So I think it's going to stop people all crowding around and watching something maybe together and at the same time, which is a good and a bad thing, I think. And I mean, I think YouTube, it's stuff, because YouTube, a lot with the vlogging as well, it's TV shows that people feel like are being made just for them, and they can get them every week, and that's why that quantity really works for YouTube.
And why we haven't
always suited YouTube too, I think, in a big way too.
No, it just appeals to people that have busy life busy lives, really, yeah, isn't it? And it's just so immediate for those sort of people. Like, I can't think of the last time I sat down and just watched TV without knowing I'm going to watch this because it's there on Planner and on Sky. And I think YouTube or the internet in general is going to be the biggest thing, really, I think.
Yeah.
And it's going to die out. Apart from, I don't know, Sky, when they have so much money, they can just blow on, like, Game of Thrones and they know people are going to watch
But I wonder, will they keep having that income stream from subscribers when people are like, actually, we can get it for free?
Yeah. I feel like it's going to get to a point where it's like the view count thing just doesn't really matter anymore.
No.
I'm always quite, I think the word cynical, where, you know, I'll sort of watch something that might be quite bad and everyone's sort of going about, oh, how many views it's got. And I was like, yeah, but it's because people aren't enjoying it. It's because it's terrible and they want to show friends. Oh, look at this terrible bit. And I kind of feel like the view count is sort of almost going out the window. It doesn't really necessarily matter. Whereas I think, fortunately for us, when we started it, it was a big deal. And it still obviously is a thing, but I kind of think it'll get to the point where the internet sort of platform and media like YouTube will be the sole thing.
Yeah.
But I think that the whole revenue stream and the view counts will be a completely different thing.
Mm. But it's weird, like for music videos and all that, which we found out with our last campaign, like to be played on radio, something that's a big kind of like thing is like view counts on music videos. If you don't have over a certain amount, they wouldn't even kind of like take it into like consideration of playing your songs. There has to be a bit of a drive behind it. So I'm not sure. I mean, it works for both.
So you've had a campaign, as you put it, to try and get your stuff on radio. Has that been successful?
And luckily we have, because of like our connections with different radio people that are behind it. But then with certain songs, like ones that we have wanted to be played, they're like, well, it's only got like 300,000 views, so it's like, what's the point in us kind of like being behind that? It's like,
what's the magic number in order to take it to
a... I think it's in the millions. I mean, it, every time, if it's not over a million, I think people look away now. And now that Psy took it to a billion and stuff, I mean, you know, and I think Sia is quite close to that with Chandelier, with the, you know, there's those videos now. I think the numbers thing's totally different now. And
you can buy views. That's the thing. Like, record companies can buy views.
Can you?
Yeah, you can.
How do you do that?
We don't know. But I mean, it happens. You can see it happens with certain, like, the likes are such a small kind of like number compared to the amount of views.
You can buy views but not likes. They're not a sensible proportion.
Video could have like 65 million views but the like count could be like 10,000. Then it doesn't make sense to kind of
that
like, yeah,
the
ratio.
First time I've heard that. That'd be a thing. I only found out like a year or two ago you could buy Twitter followers. And obviously that's kind of, you can find out if someone's done that fairly easily because they've all got robot names, but presumably by now they haven't. They've got realistic ones and actual photos scraped from Facebook. So what happens when you can buy likes as well, I wonder?
We're probably there already hacking into YouTube for that.
Have you actually got any fans? Wait a minute. This entire thing a joke of my Twitter.
Oh my god. But that's been going on from day one. I remember when Drew and I started gigging when we were kind of 14, 15 and stuff. Like, MySpace would be the same. Venues would book bands based on their MySpace followers. And I remember a band we used to gig with a lot, and they didn't have any fans, and they used to buy their MySpace things, and it was quite widely known. But they got pretty big in the circuit because of that, and it gave them the platform to play the shows, and then they kind of
got
seen.
And then when they played the shows, people were there and they got seen, and then they did use that to buy.
It was quite interesting, that world of it. So it's been happening since day one, and I'm sure it happened before the internet in ways as well. I think it's, you know,
Is there like a, I could imagine you revealing there's a secret fourth member that never comes to interviews that's the YouTube kind of YouTube virality puppet master.
I wish.
Sadly there isn't, we have to do it all ourselves, and that's why sometimes we have kind of neglected certain parts of the internet, really, like especially social media, Twitter, Instagram and Facebook. We don't have the time to kind of like constantly upload kind of like statuses and different content, and so sometimes I know the views for things are smaller because we haven't got that connection with the fans constantly, because we're making TV shows as well, and we've got other projects that we can't focus all our time on YouTube. That's why YouTubers do so well because they only focus on YouTube.
Yeah.
And like when we did the E4 show, we could see the numbers dwindle sometimes with different music videos because we didn't have that connection.
Yeah.
And we tried to keep it, but it's hard when you've got so many different things going on at the same time.
When it comes to trying to promote yourself on YouTube and get the subscribers such as you can, do you have a strategy? Are you taking advice from anyone, or are you just kind of blindly foraging in the dark going, maybe this will work?
Occasionally. I mean, there's ways that we've learned, like, you know, it might make sense to upload a video in the evening because people aren't at work, but then some people are like, oh no, it's good when they're at work because they're all going to look, or when they're at school or whatever. And it's just, we've navigated blindly, really.
That's
exactly what you said. Yeah. I mean, we've had advice from people and we've talked about bringing on someone that runs the YouTube, bring it on. And we've had days of using that, but it's never worked for us in a big way because I think a lot of the time, if you pay someone to do that, you've still got to send them what the Midnight Beast would say before they put it up. So you may as well just do it yourself. And yeah.
And it's interesting, depending what country you're uploading your videos from, you'll get more views and more subscribers. Like Norway is quite a big country for vloggers to move to because they know they'll get more of a view count from people just focusing on their videos. It's really weird and different time zones.
So
PewDiePie is the biggest thing on YouTube, his vlogs or his videos, his reviews. But it's because of the country. It's really weird. Like, my friend Zach has explained it to me. A lot of vloggers have moved to Norway because they know they're going to get a higher view count over there.
Wow. And why is that?
I think it's
in terms of percentage of the population.
Yes, it's weird. I forgot he explained it exactly what it was. But it is, you get more views in Norway than you would in America because I suppose there's a bigger population in America all trying to do YouTube videos.
Okay.
Whereas like in Norway, if you make it big, you will make
Does it
a lot bigger.
Settings when you
what's in the right hand column?
Yeah,
so
to the origin of where you are and where you uploaded it, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, it's a really weird thing, but it's down
Maybe
to
we
like
move to Norway.
Yeah, but those sort of things actually matter now when uploading stuff to YouTube. Like depending where you're uploading it and what countries and all that kind of thing. So, but we haven't done any of that. That's the point. We've done it blindly. So.
We can talk about money in a coded way if you'd like, but I'd be fascinated to know how many hits did you start? What does it translate to financially in terms of, you'd only say a number, but at what point do you start going, hang on a minute, we can quit our day jobs? Did you have day jobs?
Yeah,
we had day jobs.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, to be honest, we were never that wise to like the internet revenue stream business. I mean,
still not really.
No, I remember occasionally maybe like in the TikTok kind of like TikTok and maybe 6 months after that with those kind of hits, I remember there'd be like £200 through the door every month from Google or something.
Okay.
But I mean, that didn't carry on and it's certainly not around now. And I mean, and that wasn't like a call to kind of quit our day jobs. It was more when we got wise to the idea that we could basically release these songs on iTunes and essentially have our own record label through this amazing company called TuneCore. It was more when we started doing that that we got to the stage.
And
where
merchandise, that's how we made the money.
Yeah.
Really, from shows and, you know, people want to wear the Midnight Beast t-shirts and we made loads of different designs and all that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And that's where it kind of kicked off.
Exactly. And we always chose to keep an ownership. My dad ran a record label, Sounds Like Good, and my mum runs the Midnight Beast shop. And and Ashley's parents have always done our calendar shoots and photo shoots, and you don't want to talk about yours. And but that's always majorly helped the Midnight Beast and keep it what it is as well, because you know it sounds like a joke, but it really is how it works as well.
Yeah.
And I think and actually in the early days we didn't even used to get the merch printed until it was ordered. So we used a company, I think they were called Spreadshirt.
Yes,
and what they do is they'd essentially, you'd upload a JPEG, which we'd designed, and then someone would order it, and then they'd order it from the website,
and then
it's printed.
Yeah.
And that was very easy, and we got massive numbers from that, got a lot of merch companies offering us deals, and we said, you know what, amazing, thank you for the for the offer, but we're going to set up our own shop. Yeah. You've just like inspired us to do it. So we
thanks for the idea.
Thanks for the idea. Bye. But and then yeah, we just rented a space, made the Midnight Beast HQ, where the studio and the shop is and everything. And
does that still exist? You've got the
that,
HQ.
That exists, and it sounds a lot more glamorous than it is. But essentially, yeah. Just somewhere to record demos, yeah. And somewhere to sell, to stock the t-shirts, really. Yeah. Okay. And that's always been very lo-fi, and that's where other bands may give a cut to somebody to do that for them. We've gone, you know what, this is going to take a little more time out our day, and may mean that we have one less YouTube video online, yeah. But it means that we get ownership and we get to design the t-shirts ourselves, yeah. And all that stuff, which is great. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when did you make the leap to performing live?
That
when
was,
did you like as the Midnight Beast? When once yeah. TikTok was up, what was the brand? What was the gap between that
yeah.
and you starting to go, hang on, let's invite loads of people and do a gig?
It was really quick because yeah. we actually got. I mentioned we used to tour with our friends Hadouken, and they had a huge online following, and they
I believe I've heard one of their songs, and it's like screaming, shouting.
They were part of the new rave genre that which was. Big. It was kind of in 2007, maybe it was, and they were a MySpace band essentially. Yeah. What people talk about Arctic Monkeys and Hadouken in the same sentence for kind of making it on MySpace, and whereas we were this YouTube act, and it was weird seeing that almost our careers in parallel all being mates, and they asked us to invited us to open for them at Coco in London, and. The week before that as well, we went to a show of a band called Cobra Starship, who were big at the time, and we went to Shepherd's Bush Empire, not knowing that a couple of years later we'd be playing it as well. Yeah. And we managed to kind of creep into the VIP section and watch the show from up there, because the band had invited us along. The one point, the whole crowd turned around to us and started singing TikTok, our parody. And we'd never, ever seen that. And it was absolutely mad. And a week later, we went on stage opening for Hadouken, all shitting ourselves, you never doing a rock show.
No.
And us suddenly having the whole crowd singing the words back to us and being like, oh my God. And then a couple of weeks after that, we went down, maybe a month after that, we went down to the Great Escape Festival in Brighton, and we'd been put on, not even part of the festival, just Relentless had a stage in front of the Green Donut in Brighton. Okay. And we watched the band there before playing to a handful of people, and we were all just having a pint. No one was there.
Yeah.
They then wheeled away the PA and set up a rubbish PA.
Even smaller.
Yeah. And this one before it wasn't. And we went off to kind of get changed in my dad's car that was covered in bird poop. Just like really embarrassed, putting on our jackets and getting our swords and stuff. Came back, there were 2,000 kids on Brighton Beach. And I mean,
it was getting more security and everything. Yeah. And it was just mad.
We had a wall of five security guards holding these girls and guys. And then we had where the donut is, it curves around. It's almost a pier on the beach.
Yes.
People were climbing up and standing on the shoulders. It was absolutely insane. And that was the first time we'd ever played the Midnight Beast show, in a way. Sure. Like, six songs.
I mean, three songs. Three or four songs. Yeah.
And then presumably a black Rolls Royce pulled up and a guy got out with a cigar and lit it with a 50.
Yeah. Oh, but it was so funny because we had to be escorted through all these thousands of kids. And, you know, with a record label, a massive Merc would turn up and they were like, get in the van, but it's your dad's car with bird poo on it. Just around, I was like, get in quick.
Yeah.
It
was so funny. We got in, we drove around the block.
Kids
went
were
in
chasing
a hotel.
After the car. There's this guy who had, was his arm broken?
He had his arm in the car.
Yeah, and he was chasing after
and he fell over.
And he fell over.
And his trousers fell down. As he was sort of driving about trying to chase the van.
Oh my God.
The van covered in shit. I mean,
it was literally bird poo.
That was when we kind of realised that the view count on TikTok and by then probably Ninjas and Let's Be Friends actually meant something, that there were people there that would come and see us live.
The numbers on the screen, like, amazing, but it doesn't mean anything until they're standing there and that was a free show, and then we went on
then
tour.
We charged them.
But then you know, we still kept everything very lo-fi and put on our own tour, a headline tour, and sold that out, and And then we played Coco.
So when you say we put on our own tour and you kept it kind of homemade, is it you ringing around venues and going, we've got millions of
tickets? No, bookers there.
We had bookers with it. But again, we said to them, this is the price we want to charge. And we managed to, because, you know, we had the numbers on YouTube, it gave us a lot of control walking into those meetings.
We still had to create control, whereas they did all the sort of legwork in terms of venues and sizes. But we very much said, like, this is the show we want to put on. They came down to the rehearsal room and saw the show that we pretty much performed to them, just to kind of say, this is what it is.
Yeah.
This is what we want to do. Because it was very much a rock / cabaret show. We, we'd run off the side of the stage, put on different costumes and silly props. Mm. So, you know, we had to have like little, it sounds diva-ish, but, you know, wing requirements just so that we could like change and then come back on. So,
and we tried the idea when we were doing it live of kind of having like sketchy bits almost. And it just didn't...
Because what they want is a rock game.
What they want is a rock show. They want to just scream back the songs. And that's all we wanted to... You know, we're not improv comedy guys. And it, in between songs, we all get kind of shy and a little introvert. And like, but
and
then,
they love that. Look how shy they are.
But then when, but then when the beat comes on, we just kind of come in and do our thing. And that's what made sense. So we just kept it that after a while.
Yeah.
It was mad. Awesome. But in to answer the question, it was probably about a month after TikTok went up that we did that Coco show.
And then we started headlining festival tents, which was kind of... That was the craziest thing, really. Like, T4 at the Beach. We headlined the smaller stage, but, like, 40,000 people were there, wasn't it? It was like 20,000 or something crazy. Yeah. And then we headlined the Festival Republic tent at Reading and Leeds, and that's when it was... I think that was my favourite show, to be honest. Yeah. Like, the tent was completely packed, and...
I mean, that was bizarre, doing that, and, like, we had a mosh pit on one... we were playing House Party, which was one of our... Songs we did with the BBC.
It was BBC comedy. It was about the election.
Yeah, it was about the election. Yes. We were running our own party, and we had... kids moshing and making a mosh circle
to Nick Clegg
and just thinking, like,
each other up.
We were sort of doing that based off a video that we put up, you know, a couple of years back. There was a parody of
which, if
of
you have TikTok. Seen it, it's not violent whatsoever. Yeah. There's no violence in it.
It's just very bizarre, kind of headlining the Festival Republic at Reading and Leeds, having put up a TikTok parody, really, that kind of led to it. You know what I mean?
Just, I'm aware that we're running low on time, so there's a couple of three things left I want to hit. One is that one of your YouTube videos is you performing at the Edinburgh Fringe in the BBC comedy tent to near silence. And I just wanted to ask you about that, because up until this point, like, a question I've kept wanting to ask for the last hour is, is there any part of your life or work that isn't 100% fun? Do you know what I mean? You just seem to have just nailed this on all levels. I mean, it seemed to me like you'd been put in the wrong kind of show for you.
Yeah, I mean, that happens quite often. We really prefer being the comedy act in a music festival rather than the music act in a comedy festival.
Yes, okay.
We love comedy, and it's amazing hanging out with comedians. And we went to Montreal just for last festival, and we're hanging out with all our mates now, and they're all comedians, and we feel insane to be a part of it. And but then when we go on stage, a comedy audience don't always want music, whereas a music audience love the light relief of comedy. And we like sticking out on the bill, and I think a lot of the time being the musical act on a comedy isn't the right sticking out, whereas the other way around, it's something interesting. And there's just something, it's not even to do with comedy fans, it's just to do with people that are in the mood for music and loud noises.
And we did a few nights at the Other Belly as well, particular festival that year, and that sold out. It was awesome. But the fans were kind of like jumping up and down. If you see the Other Belly, it's all seated still.
They had
to get security in to like tell them to sit down.
Break the venue.
But at the end, everyone was still jumping around and everything, and they just went, oh fuck it, just let them do what they want.
We like the chaos.
That's the thing. I think it's a kind of like an energy thing, because obviously when we do a live show, it's predominantly just standing up rock show. So if we're playing to a seated audience, we kind of burst out, and it's like, wee! And then it's kind of like, okay, we've really got to overly kind of like, tone the songs and stuff.
But. Yeah, it works, because, you know, we don't want people analysing every move we're doing. We want them enjoying themselves in the moment. And I think we don't want the audience to be too comfortable, because that's not what a rock show is about. And, and that's why we've always really suited festivals and suited standing venues. And I think that often isn't something that goes hand in hand with comedy. And that's where it's been interesting to walk the line, I think.
So going back to the very beginning of our conversation, we were talking about your new work with Comedy Central.
Yes.
And it's going to be the first thing you've done with no songs isn't it?
Yeah.
So is that a deliberate decision on your part to go, oh, we've had enough of smashing it at festivals?
No, I mean, so basically, we often felt like we wouldn't have enough time between writing music for TV and writing music for radio and, and YouTube. They often don't always translate on both levels, I don't think. If you're writing a song for a TV show, as we discussed earlier, you want to push a narrative forward. That doesn't work so well if you don't have the visual and you're listening to it on the radio, or if you're watching it out of context on YouTube. So what we've decided to do for the next kind of phase of the Midnight Beast is to separate the two so that the music is really good and you can listen to it and get it, you can watch the YouTube video and get it, but and it's not particularly part of a TV show, but then a TV show that is equally as good, that doesn't need to rely on music being the call to the gags, but the TV show we've been writing at the moment has been where the script is saying, you know, the pop culture gags that the Midnight Beast have always done and stuff, and what we're saying about modern day life and technology and things like that, and it's obviously about the kind of things that our songs are about, but yet the ideal scenario is that the two of them can fuel each other's fire, and you know, the music can promote the show can promote the music, but both of them can exist on their own, I think.
Yeah. So I wanted to be rock stars and comedians.
Lovely.
There it is, and actors, yeah, so there we go.
And is one of you going to go to Hollywood? Are you going to get, if this, I mean, is that the potential flaw in the system if you do become successful comedians doing your own show? And what if one of you gets picked up and they go, oh, we need Drew to be in the next Batman movie?
True. I mean,
the price goes right up. You want me back, boys? It'd be one of the things we'll just, you know, see how the show goes, because at the moment it's only pilot, so
And as long as Christopher Nolan doesn't mind a TikTok parody.
The Avengers always need new heroes.
We bring our own dance. That's fine.
So very last question then. You're something I enjoy asking people. Obviously you've got a lot of like between your kind of your group dynamic, your creativity, how innovative you are, how like you've got this incredible kind of musical backbone, you've got the core of the editing, the production, all those things. What are your weaknesses? If you were to review your own live show, what would be the things that you'd go, actually, let's hope no one notices, but we're not very good at this, or we want to be better at that?
I think a lot of the time we haven't felt affiliated with comedy, and I think I think that's been a strength and a weakness in a lot of things, because it's meant we haven't overthought things, but it's meant we also kind of feel like, oh, we don't fit into that world, and I think it's often the case with music too, where we're a little too comedy to fit in the musical world, and while I'll put that out there as a weakness, that sometimes we fall through the cracks of the two, that we don't get a chance to be on the radio because maybe the songs are a little too funny, definitely. Or we don't get a chance to play every comedy festival or go down well because it's a little too musical. We often fall through the cracks, but that is our main weakness, but I think it's also our main strength in a big way, because it's hard for people to put a finger on it, and I think that scares people a lot of the time. But
this is an excellent and typically Stefanish answer. you have carefully turned the weakness into a strength. I'm going to put the question to you guys as well, just because it's not like I'm going, tell me your weak spots. How can I destroy the Midnight Beast? Yeah. But I'm just interested in like.
I would agree with Stefan. Like, we'd love to. No, but it's true. We'd love to support certain bands, and we know we would go down well, but. You know, the powers that be that control these will not control the bands, but kind of like, you know, in charge of their careers and stuff, wouldn't get us necessarily, because they were like, you're too comedy to support, I don't know, like Katy Perry or something, and when we know
that's
we would go down
so
really well.
You would absolutely smash that,
yeah.
And is that so you've inquired about doing that, but you haven't managed to get.
And Fall Out Boy and all these kind of bands where we know we'd go down because they had the same fan base as us,
yes.
But they don't understand that comedy music can actually work at a show supporting one of these rock bands.
No, because people are scared by it.
Because we play instruments on stage, we do all those sort of things, and people are jumping around and moshing out and all that. But you know, sometimes people just don't understand what we do, which is it's fine.
And is there a way around that? Is there a way to? Have you got a sort of a strategy to go? No, hang on, we should be out there.
I think we do, and I think that's with our next album. I think we've really worked out what needs to happen. and strategized it a lot better and got on the right. Well, we had a different management. We've got music management now, and I think it all was just
And then when you're booked as a band first and foremost, then you turn up and you do what you want.
Yeah,
and then they see it happen.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly. It. Yeah, because you have to see us live to get it. I think you can watch the videos, you can watch our show, and you're like, okay, that's I can see it. But when you see us live, I think that's the best thing we can actually do.
Yeah,
people are like, yeah, I fucking get it, and I see the, you know, the people moshing around and jumping around. Yeah. I completely get it now.
Yeah,
yeah. But until they see us live, some people are like, oh, I don't get it.
Yeah,
it's annoying. But
I think for me, whilst I don't want to contradict anything we said about the sort of types of venues that we play in and stuff, and obviously Steph mentioned the Montreal Festival. I think it would be quite a thing. I've always felt like we've never really gone that full comedic route, like playing to a seated down audience. We did a really cool The Sun Biz Sessions where we did three tracks just sort of on an acoustic guitar, and then me and Ash had a couple of like silly prop kind of instruments. And it was just really quite stripped back and really more about the sort of lyrics and the vocals. And it kind of felt like it was a bit of a, yeah, just more of a kind of comedy unit rather than like this kind of like Beastie Boys rock kind of rock show. And I kind of feel like maybe that's one thing we've never fully explored. But I think because we've straddled that line of comedy and music, and we've always been daunted by, you know, we're comedians, because it's like, oh, fucking, that's a big deal.
Yeah.
But I feel like, yeah, that's maybe one thing I kind of feel we've always lent. We've laid to our strengths rather than kind of actually throwing ourselves out there and think, okay, cool, let's strip the song down, like really kind of like actually spell out the lyrics of what we're saying.
And is that the source of any kind of tension in the band? Do you argue? Do you go, actually, we should be aiming at this? Because obviously, you know, pursuing the thing of like following Fallout Boy, that could occupy, sorry, fully supporting Fallout Boy, or replacing Fallout Boy. Yeah. You know, that could occupy all your time. Writing a new show could occupy your time. Yeah. Working on a live at the Apollo seated audience hour and a half show could occupy all your time.
We've certainly had like little tiffs and little scraps, but I don't think anything because of that. I think I sort of, whilst I kind of think that's a slight regret that we maybe haven't pushed that side of things, I sort of understand why. And if anything, like, kind of agreeing with Steph, although you wanted a different answer. You know, that is our strength and our weakness, is, you know, because we know what we're good at doing and we're confident doing that. And I definitely have fully enjoyed what we've done doing that. But I think it would, you know, it's always that kind of what if, had we done a couple more shows in that kind of side of things. Or, because I certainly feel like when we did do the Just for Laughs Festival, as I said, the first kind of song or two, we went out all guns blazing like it was our normal show, and then realising, actually, hang on, everyone's seated down, they've got a drink in hand, they've just watched the likes of Joe Lycett or Eric Lampere, and it's like, okay, let's actually like just rein in a little. And it was quite a challenge, but it was also fun. It was a learning curve. Yeah, I don't think it was ever a kind of like, oh, why haven't we done this, guys? It's more just that would be an experiment, you know, and who knows, maybe we would do, you know, next year, like a show like that or something. And it's never a sort of thing we would never do, I don't think.
And I don't know about you guys, but I never know what to say when somebody goes, what do you do as a career? It's always like, what do we do as a career? Because I still don't know. That's the thing. Like, we create music, but then we also like write shows and stuff. And then they're always confused. They're like, okay, so what have you done? You're going,
everything apart from ventriloquism.
But that kind of, I think, sums us up. We still don't know what we are and what we do, really.
To a point where, do you put, like, if someone says describe the band or what you guys do, it's like, do you put the music first or comedy? It's like, we're a comedic band, but, you know, we kind of are comfortable saying that we're more musicians than comedians, so what do you say first? Yeah,
so we do real fake rap. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys.
I think that's, we finally did, like, we've come to the bottom of it. What's the weakness of the Midnight Beast? Is too many options.
So true.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So that was Steph, Drew and Ashley, a.k.a. The Midnight Beast. You can follow them on Twitter at Midnight Beast UK. Please do yourself a favour. Get on YouTube. Get on the 4OD where you can still find the last two series. And get stuck into the... Just experience The Midnight Beast for yourselves. Because sooner or later, you're going to be at a music festival or have the opportunity to see them live. And that show will absolutely erase your memory, as they say. So when you see that show, it'd just be good if you already knew their stuff in advance. So get your homework done. Seek out The Midnight Beast. Go and see one of their DJ sets. They sound great as well. But you know, they might not be the sorts of thing, the sort of thing that you would normally encounter, but they, you've got to put them in your life. They're so much fun. And thank you to the boys for coming on the show. I've been Stuart Goldsmith. Thank you for listening. Remember, hashtag get me Jackie Chan and get your tickets at SohoTheatre.com with the discount code FAF to come and see me interview Nina Conti, the brilliant ventriloquist and cabaret and comedy star Nina Conti, on May the 5th at Soho Theatre. And that is everything. Thanks to Nathan for co-production skills. And I'm off to bed now because I'm exhausted after an extremely full few days of gigging and run-throughs and podcasts and all sorts. I'm going to Estonia on Wednesday and I'll see you at McCuncliffe. I said its name. I said its name. I'll burn. See you soon.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.